Well, good morning. If you were here a couple of weeks ago, you'd have realised that you shouldn't have come today because I was speaking then as well. So maybe some of you weren't listening 2 weeks ago. John the Baptist was a person of some renown. We sometimes just locate him as though he's a person only of the Bible and hardly anyone would have been reading that or known about it. That's not true. He's actually mentioned by the Jewish historian Josephus, and he's given his nickname. I really think it is a bit like a nickname. In his work, he does refer to him as John the Baptist. Well, now, all Anglicans know he's not really a Baptist. We won't let them claim him for themselves. And in fact, it's not a very helpful translation. It's not even a translation. It's a transliteration. And this is unfortunate. It's unfortunate with a lot of these transliterations. In other words, what has happened is we've simply taken the Greek word, and in Latin they did the same. They invented new words in the Latin. Wherever they came across the verb or the nouns or a few nouns associated with it, and they just said, oh, Baptist, baptizing. It's actually not helpful. If you'd have asked Josephus what he meant when he referred to John the Baptist, he wouldn't have said John the Baptist at all. But if he was speaking English, he would have said something like, oh, you know, the fellow was immersing people left, right and centre. John the Immerser, that's what we call him. And that's probably the way we should refer to him, John the Immerser or something like that. John was exceedingly unusual in that he was doing something that, as far as we know, no one else actually did. You see, in that part of the world where, and in other parts of the world where washing ceremonies were very important, washing yourself before a meal, after a meal, before a formal function, sometimes actually going to have a bath before you had went to a banquet because you thought that was the proper thing to do, you always immersed yourself. You did it. You washed yourself. You dunked yourself. What was so unusual about this man, John, was that he dunked you. And in so doing, he was obviously declaring himself and acting in the form of a prophet of God. In other words, it wasn't appropriate for you to wash yourself. What could you do about washing yourself from the sins that you were guilty of? You needed a prophet, as it were, to step in on behalf of God and to do something for you. And he dunked you. Now, generally, yeah, more often than not, or thereabouts, the verb to baptize, to immerse, was associated with the sinking of ships or the drowning of people. It had a death character to it. And I take it that, in fact, when John was doing his immersing, he was in part declaring that you needed to die to your old way of thinking, your old behavior. You needed to, and then presumably you came up out of the waters into, as it were, new life. Now, I've only gone into the detail about John to indicate how well known he was in the ancient world. We know that he did a lot of this immersing in two different spots, one further south, one further north. And we know that great crowds of people turned out to see what he was doing, and great crowds were, in fact, immersed by him. I'll have to use the word baptized because that's the more familiar word, and I'll fall into that trap anyway, so forgive me for now reverting to that. He baptized oodles of people, oodles of people. So he was well known. He was so well known that, in fact, he could make a claim that bounded off, reflected upon his being well known. Someone who's come after me, greater than I, you wouldn't ever make that sort of statement, would you, if you didn't think, in fact, that there was some significance about yourself, would you? See, someone greater than I has come after me, but in fact he outranks me. Now, that's the first part of the little passage we're looking at today. He has priority. So I think that John may have been speaking about the timing of their births. They weren't very far apart. John was born first, Jesus was born second. He may have had that in mind. Perhaps more importantly, he may have had in mind who went public first. Well, John went public first. He was there before Jesus was actually involved in public ministry. So he may have had that in mind, and more importantly, he may have had that in mind. But then he wants to make the claim, but that person who has come after me, in fact, is before me. Now, we may want to write some theological things into that and say, well, he's referring to his being with the Father before he ever came as a man to this earth. And in fact, maybe John's gospel is opening that possibility up for us in the way that he refers to what John says. If you wanted someone to say something nice about you, and we surely all every now and again want someone to say something nice about us, it'd be nice if they told us, wouldn't it? I mean, somehow or other, if someone said, oh, so-and-so was just mentioning you the other day and just said how well-dressed you were. They'd never say that about me, by the way, only after I've been done over with my dear wife who makes things look a lot better than they otherwise normally would be. But it would be nice to hear about it, wouldn't it, that someone said something nice about you. Imagine if the person who was saying something nice about you was actually fairly significant themselves, you see. You know, they were well known for their musical ability or oratory or poetry or, I don't know, just being a good wife or a good husband or a good dad or something or other. Imagine if they were well known for that, and then you heard that they said you were even better than they were in that area. My word, wouldn't that be to your credit? Wouldn't that be to our credit if that occurred? Well, what is written in John's gospel is that not only was John the Immerser reacting that way with respect to Jesus, saying he was even greater than John himself, who was getting quite a name, the prophet from God. Not only is that the case, the way that John's gospel reports it is that John the Immerser actually yelled it out. He went public. It wasn't just to one other person that John spoke this way about Jesus. This is what he was saying publicly. See, imagine that, what that would do for our self-inflated, self-focused egos. If this person who was so good at something said we were even better and went public. That's what it says about John. We mustn't miss those words. He cried out in testimony about this person, Jesus. He cried out in testimony. And then the writer then says, and I'm going to use slightly different translations than what we had read out to us. I'm going to be a bit more literal. I think what the translation, the next bit, is quite a, you know, quite a reasonable. Who am I to make a judgment like that, by the way? Please don't come to me afterwards and say, what sort of expertise have you got in this area? Answer, none. But I'll just refer to it more literally. You see, what the writer then says is, the fullness of him, Jesus, the fullness of him, is revealed in grace being upon grace. You know, one blessing after another we have in our translation. Grace upon grace. This is something outstanding. It's the first reference you have to something about Jesus just after having mentioned that John cries out about him. The fullness, grace upon grace, being received by all. Notice, by the way, the big words, fullness, grace upon grace, all. Surely it's got to be in principle all that the grace upon grace has been shown to us from the fullness of this one Jesus. Whew, all. I think, you see, what's happening is John, the writer, is saying, for you, the reader, this grace upon grace is possible because it's possible for all. And where do you fit in this? Are you one of the all in principle? Are you one, in fact, of the all in principle? I think that's what John's trying to get at. He's trying to get at the reader. This is to be read, or it's to be listened to as it's being read by someone else. And we've got to have a response. And John is expecting us to make some sort of response. Grace upon grace. It does seem like overwhelming stuff, doesn't it? Fullness, grace upon grace, all of us. When I first thought about this grace upon grace, I know this may seem a little strange, but you know that's what Barry's like a bit. I was actually thinking of Lord Howe Island. And I was thinking of Lord Howe Island in drought and in wet conditions. I've just been there last year for a few months, and I've been there a few other times, and They talk about the dry months of January, February. I don't know what it's like there at the moment and so on, but they talk about water shortages. And in the precincts of where the Anglican church is and the Anglican rectory and the Anglican garage that was crushed by a tree, there are 5 water tanks. They're huge water tanks. And one of my jobs when I go there, I find, is to get up and clean out the sieve where all the leaves have fallen into, where the water's actually got to pour into it. And during the summer months, people actually have become very much more careful. Tourists don't care two hoots about what they're doing with the water, but the locals do. And one of these 5 pumps, at least one of them, doesn't actually belong to the church. It's actually on church grounds, but it's for public use in times of emergency. So things can be that bad. But I'll tell you what, in the winter, when it pours raining, one of the most delightful things you hear is the water pouring out of the top pipes on all 4 tanks. It just pours out, pours out, pours out. Water upon water, water upon water. That which is needed for life, abundantly displayed under the good hand of God. Grace upon grace. It's a most unusual phrase. I really should have checked it up, if I could have, to see with some sort of idiomatic expression in the Greek language. I just don't know. It could be an idiom for just saying something like an abundance. It certainly has that ring about it, doesn't it? An abundance of grace. Well, what's grace all about? Of course it has to do with kindness. You know, and I noticed that this morning as we came into church, there were a couple of little grandkids, and they spoke to their grandma and their granddad as they came in and used whatever the appropriate terms were, I've forgotten. I've got a grandson who calls his other grandfather Mupa. That's because he's on a farm and has cows. Certainly it enables him to be distinguished from myself. Grandparents, you hope, and normally it's the case, are known to be kind people. And that's part of grace. It's having a disposition of kindness. They want to be kind. They like to be kind. Hopefully, they like to be kind to those little ones. Rich, wealthy grandparents do not only have a disposition of kindness, they often give out lots of goodies whenever the grandkids come to their house. And then they can make comparisons between that grandpa and grandmother over there, perhaps not so well off, who don't distribute the chocolate so readily, with these grandparents that you're now visiting and who give you such goodies. Oh, the bribery of grandparents. But you see, with this man Jesus in his fullness, not only has the disposition of kindness, but he is able to actually display that kindness in his action, grace upon grace. And so the writer John then has to deal with, well, we have to understand something about this grace. What is it? What is it, this grace that is so attached to this Jesus? It's so overwhelmingly part of him. It's part of his fullness that this grace should come out abundantly. What is its nature? What is its nature is what John now deals with. And so he does talk about, to begin with, a kind act of God. It was in the kindness of God that the law was given to the Jewish people. It enabled them to understand something about righteousness and evil and justice and obedience and love. In the kindness of God, the law was given through Moses. I think purposefully John then chooses a different verb to say, ah, but what has come through Jesus Christ? So the law was given through Moses, and then he says, but truth and grace came. I think he intentionally uses a different word. It's sort of given, but this came. It's very much more personal. It's actually been delivered on the spot, as it were. Grace and truth came through this Jesus Christ. When you first came across that, and if you've been thinking about it, what came to your mind when you noticed the word truth? If you were thinking about it, Ah, the law was given through Moses, but truth and grace. Did you perhaps think that, was he suggesting there was something false about the law? That wouldn't be right, would it? That wouldn't seem right, so we have to dismiss that. Why is John writing here about truth? You might have thought he would have just said, ah, but grace, and there'd be no word truth at all. Now, I'm not sure. I'm just offering what I suspect is the case. But what John is saying, and by the way, he's very colourful in the way he uses language, and he can use it in a number of different forms. It can be a bit ambiguous. He can float with it a meaning of a word here and then go off over in that direction. And when he reports what Jesus said on some occasions, Jesus is doing exactly the same thing. He will use a word that has a sort of a meaning over there, but then he moves over there and so on over somewhere else. I suspect that what John is saying is, but the reality of our relationship with God, we have now come to only understand through Jesus, who he is and what he's done. So there's an extra element to our understanding has come with Jesus. Sure, in the kindness of God, the law was given. I'm pretty sure that that's the sort of thing that John has in mind when he reports this. But truth, an ultimate understanding of what we need to know, if we think about our relationship with God, well, that came through Jesus Christ. In the Reformation era, one of the most concentrated areas of theological thought was on the death of Jesus. What does it really mean? What was accomplished then? And associated with that, highly associated with that, was the whole business of, how can any man, any woman stand before God ever to be justified, ever to be declared righteous, ever to become a friend of God's, ever to enter into a decent, abiding, deep relationship with God? What is the secret to the death of Jesus? And how does it tie in with our relationship with God? It's always been an important matter. It's always been an important theological issue. I've been talking with a friend the other day about the resurrection of Jesus. The resurrection of Jesus, unfortunately, has often just become assumed in Christian preaching and in Christian thinking. And certainly it was assumed in the Reformation period because everyone understood, you know, in that Christian sort of European world, yes, of course, Jesus rose again from the dead. So what I'm getting at is, no, but the death of Jesus was the real pressure point of the preaching of the reformers in the end. Why? Because it is so poorly understood that in the death of this person, Jesus Christ, the great kindness of God, grace upon grace, was displayed, in that we can never, ever form a relationship with God unless it's through this Jesus Christ, from whom comes grace upon grace. I'll tell you what, it's one of the most difficult things in the world to believe. It is really one of the most difficult things in the world to believe that I can only be justified before God out of his own kindness, out of his own abundant kindness displayed through his Son. I cannot get there myself. Sorry, you cannot, you cannot. I've heard of one person who just objects, apparently, to being declared a sinner. Okay, don't like being called a sinner. Just face up to the reality, you're just not good enough for God. That's the reality. Just not good enough for God. None of us are. See, the truth that comes with this grace is the only way we can have a relationship with God is through this Jesus Christ who died for us. And God put his stamp of approval on him by raising him from the dead. And then he concludes, and we're concluding with this. He concludes with this little bit about, nobody's ever seen God. How will you ever know anything about him, really? And of course he declared elements of himself through the prophets in the ancient world. But John's not going to go into those little bits of aside. He just says, no one's ever seen God. No one's ever seen God. And now I'm actually going to use a literal translation. But the one and only Son, in the bosom of the Father, has declared him. Now, it's got this notion of, you know, bosom. We don't normally use that word in our Western world. It's a bit too, you know, effeminate and so on and sexually orientated. But in the ancient world, it was a phrase that you would use of a confidant, someone with whom someone else took into extreme confidence about all sorts of matters. Often between a man and a man, sometimes, unfortunately, homosexually orientated. But let's put that aside. For a person to have someone, as it were, in his bosom would be someone whom he had a great affection for, told his deepest secrets to, gave his yearnings publicity to, yearned for their affection, as it were, but reveal things about themselves, things that he or she may not have revealed to someone else. Of course, that sort of confident characteristic can be displayed in a marriage today between a husband and a wife. A husband might tell a wife things that he would tell no one else. A wife might tell a husband things she would tell no one else. Perhaps for a child that you had a tremendous bonding with, perhaps you had lost a husband or lost a wife, that child now became your confidant, the person whom you reveal things to. Just recently, my wife and I received an email, and it was addressed, I think it went something like, "Dear good friends." The email wasn't sent to many people. We don't know how many, but it wasn't sent to many. And she was just telling us about something medically terrible about her husband, our friend. I won't go into the details. That's not important for the illustration. But there were just a few of us, you see, being informed by the wife who had been informed by the husband. And it's terrible. That's the sort of thing that John is now talking about. The one and only son, the confidant of his father, who his father reveals everything to. Nothing is hidden from the son, you'll later on find John saying. That's the one, the one and only son, in the bosom of the father. He knows the father. He has declared him. You see, if anyone cries out today and says, "I want to know about God," read John's gospel. Hear what Jesus says and does, and you will know about God. Okay, that's the little passage. It's going to be very hot today. I feel a little bit hot up here. It might help you to relieve yourself from this heat if you'd like to ask a question now. Just get you a bit more active.